Good afternoon. I was going to tell you something about black hole cinema, and I was asked quite properly, what in the world is black hole cinema? I'm going to talk about how to make not just images, but movies of black holes that resolve their event horizons, how we're doing that now, and what we can do with that. Of course, this is an extensive project. There are a number of people who are working with me directly, shown in nearly imperceptible yellow here. A number of these are students and postdocs, but also the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration, which is of order 200 people spread across the globe. And all credit and glory should go to all of them. All the errors are mine. So first off, what are we really after? We're after the nature and the times of supermassive black holes. And what that means depends on who you ask. If you ask physicists, a black hole is a very specific space-time structure. The LIGO people are positive that that is all black holes are. They're fully characterized by three numbers in principle, of which only two are relevant for the astronomer: mass and angular momentum. And so the fundamental questions physicists might have about these things are, do they exist? That is, are there things that are well described by the Kerr metric or Schwarzschild and have the qualitative features of black holes, like event horizons, et cetera? To the astronomer, black holes are a very different thing. And that's because astronomers don't see black holes in isolation. They see them in the middle of vast quantities of stuff. And it's one of the perverse jokes of the universe that black holes are both the darkest things we imagine and also the brightest objects in the universe. Black holes, both stuff, are very bright. And so the astronomer might be asking, we were talking about fundamental questions about black holes, is how do they grow to their enormous sizes, especially these supermassive objects, which I'll say more about in a bit. How do they produce all of this luminosity, not just in order of magnitude blackboard terms, but practically? What do the accretion flows look like? And how do they launch the outflows? And I have two examples of supermassive black holes in which material is not going in, but rather out. So here's Centaurus A. There's the optical image of the galaxy here in the middle, and then a radio image of these large extended relativistic features with stuff flying outward, radio jets. Here's Cygnus A, another example that shows, again, relativistic jets terminating at large distances from the central supermassive black hole. Again, stuff going outward. And it turns out that these jets are not incidental. They are fundamental to understanding why the sky looks the way it does. They can extend for many times the distance between galaxies, carve out large holes in the intercluster gas surrounding galaxies, and controlling how much gas can accrete. This is a process called feedback, which over the past two decades has been recognized to be critical to understanding the evolution of massive galaxies. All of these questions, the physicist's questions and the astronomer's questions, could be answered at least in part by studying the dynamics of stuff on horizon scales. Okay, and this is really what we're talking about today: direct imaging of supermassive black holes on scales that resolve their event horizons. That's hard because black holes might be massive, but they're also very compact. Here's a simulated image of a black hole, and I'll say a little bit more about what goes into these sorts of simulations later. But for now, this large ring-like feature we're seeing is the lensed image of the event horizon, and its typical size is about 10 gravitational radii, 10 gm over c squared across. Okay, and for the black hole at the center of the Milky Way, it's 4 million solar masses and 8 kiloparsecs away. It is not the most massive black hole, but it is the closest supermassive black hole. This scale is 53 microarcseconds. Okay, there's about 200,000 arcseconds in a radian. And this is 53 microarcseconds. So it's an atypical unit, even in astronomy, exceedingly small. It turns out that Sagittarius Star is the largest black hole on the sky. If you look at different distances, we have more massive objects further away. The key second object would be M87. This is the supermassive black hole at the large elliptical at the center of Virgo. That's 2,000 times more massive than Sagittarius star, but it's also 2,000 times further away, so its angular scale is similar at 50 microarcseconds. Everything else is below that. That doesn't mean that there aren't other things we have yet to find. There are these new ultra-massive black holes. One of them, admittedly a slightly old mass estimate, would put it as our third source, so that's kind of exciting. But realistically, if you want to answer some of those questions by direct imaging, 50 microarcseconds is the kind of scale you have to hit.
Harry, this is where? The NGC?
NGC 1276.
So this is 100 megaparsec away. Where is it?
Are you asking what cluster it's located in?
Yeah.
I don't know off the top of my head. It's that direction. There we go.
What's that in meters?
What's that in meters? A parsec is 3 × 10⁻⁶ meters, yeah?
The diameter of the event horizon.
Oh, what's the diameter of the event horizon in meters? Okay, so if you mean the aerial radius.
You said it was a light minute, right?
It's somewhere around, a light minute.
Orbit of
40 light seconds.
Like 10 to the 7 kilometers or something.
Really? Somewhere around 10 to the 12 centimeters. So, yeah, 10 to the 7 kilometers, yep.
10 to the 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's 24 light years away.
Yeah.
Okay.
All 77 is in Perseus. Perseus.
Okay, so what is achieving that resolution mean? If we wanted to put a couple pixels across this image, we would have to be able to read the dime, a Canadian dime on the other side of the Earth, or since we were talking about hockey rinks as a unit of area, I'm gonna reduce that. We wanna be able to see the hockey puck on the moon. Who wants to see the rink? You wanna be able to watch the game? And unfortunately, the diffraction limit gets in the way of that. So Hubble, a venerable and excellent instrument, is 2,000 times too low a resolution just from the diffraction limit, just from the aperture size and the wavelength of the light it observes to watch the hockey game on the moon. Next generation telescopes, 200 times too small. There is a way to get these extraordinary resolutions, very long baseline interferometry. An example of an instrument dedicated to that is the Very Long Baseline Array. And effectively what it does is it places dishes around the Earth that fill in the mirror. Okay, and the purpose of the mirror in astronomy is to reflect all the light back to focus at the same time. So instead, you measure the electric field at each one of these stations, and on a computer after the fact, in a process called correlation, you bring it to focus and you make your images. That's a vastly oversimplified version of the process, and the people who do it might feel chagrined, but that's essentially the idea. Okay, the Very Long Baseline Array is unfortunately about a factor of 3 or so too low resolution to do this experiment.
What's limiting that resolution? It's the timing between the sites?
It's the wavelengths it observes at. So we're diffraction. So very long baseline interferometers are limited by lambda over the distance between their largest, most distant dishes. And very long baseline array observes at 7 millimeters, shortest wavelength.
There are satellites which are used.
There are, yes, yes. Right. So practically, so Radio Astron and VSOP2, I think. Right. But there are a number of other reasons to move to shorter wavelengths here as well. Optical depths or optical thickness is one. But we'd like to be able to kick the instrument if it fails. Okay. So that brings me to the EHT, the event horizon. Yeah.
Have people come up with ways to do go beyond the Earth?
This was satellite dishes. Yeah, yeah. We can talk more about that later. But typically,
yes.
Satellite. Yeah. Right. You put a satellite on a highly elliptical orbit and it fills in the rosette. There are a number of practical difficulties, but we can talk about that later.
Okay.
So the Event Horizon Telescope is a collaboration that's tasked with making something like the VLBA at millimeter wavelengths capable of resolving Sagittarius star. It's a global collaboration. There are 13 partner institutions. There are more than 40 affiliated institutions. We have feet on 5 of 7 continents. Somewhat surprisingly, We don't have Australia in the mix, even though they have a long history of radio astronomy. We are looking at sighting a potential future dish or future station in Africa. So there's a time in the not-too-distant future when we could be located in all seven continents. And here at Perimeter, we support this in part by the Event Horizon Telescope Initiative, which is an initiative to bring bright people together to try to build some of the analysis toolkit to understand what we're looking at and answer some of those questions. The Event Horizon Telescope is not a brand new machine in the sense that there has been a proto-EHT or a small array that has existed for more than a decade now that has proven the ability to run these sorts of observations and already produce science results. And that consists of a station in Hawaii, a station in Arizona, and a now defunct station in California. Unfortunately, Karma is no longer with us. SMA JCMT, Canada is of course involved in the JCMT.
Is that Karma involved there?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they've never heard that joke before. Moving on. Okay, so there are a number of science results, a number of first detection of horizon scale structure, direct detection of horizon scale structure in any one of these systems. First detection of horizon scale structured magnetic fields, et cetera. So we have been busy with this. But I'm very pleased to say that as of April last year, and as of 2 weeks ago again, we have been able to field a much larger array that consists of nine different stations spread across seven different sites in the world. These include stations in Hawaii, a number of stations in North America, including the LMT in Mexico, ALMA, located in Chile, and APEX in Chile, the South Pole Telescope, and a station in Europe, the Euron 30-meter dish in Pico Valletta. And what you can't see on this map, because it's showing the view from the galactic center, is the Greenland Telescope, which would be located just over the horizon up there, which can see M87. Okay, so we have two sets of observations with all of these instruments operating together. What can you do with that? The Event Horizon Telescope really is an imaging instrument. It will be the highest resolution imaging instrument in the history of astronomy. An example of us trying to do this was at least a simulation of doing this is shown here, where data was taken from a simulated image, run through an image reconstruction pipeline, and plugging this picture in, remember the horizon is this lens is indicated by this lensed ring here, is clearly visible. The structure here is clearly visible in the reconstructed image. So we do expect to be able to make images that resolve the event horizon in the future. So what are the latest results? So the first thing I can tell you is that April 2017, everything went very, very well. April 2018, just a couple weeks ago, everything went very well again. All things look good so far. The data has to be physically shipped from the stations to the correlation facilities where it's all time delayed and brought into focus. That means that we only get the data back from the South Pole in the fall. It was in November, and so the correlation was redone as of November. That means I don't have images to show you. We do have multiple epochs of observations for the galactic center, Sagittarius A star, and M87. Okay, so we do have multiple observations. Typically, there'll be an observation at the beginning of each April campaign and at the end. And we have already begun the imaging and analysis of AGN that are not the galactic center and M87. And this summer, we will begin the process of imaging and analysis. Of course, that doesn't mean people are just sitting around. It means that the correlation and calibration is proceeding apace right now. The downside is I can't say anything publicly yet, and so to avoid this from being a very short talk, instead, I was going to tell you about what we're going to do. So the key message is that first image is great, but all of the targets of the EHT exhibit structural variations on a wide variety of time scales, and each one of those types of structural variations tell us something different about black holes and their environments. And so while the first image is great, the next 100 are better. That's why I want to talk about black hole cinema, not black hole imaging. And so now I'm going to go through a list of different timescales, starting at the longest, and tell you about some of the things we will be able to say. So the first is supermassive black hole jitter, and the timescale is decades. So this is this picture I've shown you again. I'll tell you more about what goes into making these simulated images in a moment. But for now, I want to note that this lensing feature tells you where the mass is. And for Sagittarius Star, the mass is something like 4 million solar masses. But what we're actually looking at is this emitting plasma in a disk, which has a mass that's measured in Earth masses. Okay, so this light is really the foam upon the sea, and the black hole is the ocean. Okay? So just watching the light move around is insufficient, because you're just watching the foam flop around. That could just be changes in the structure of the accretion flow. But if you watch the mass move around, you could use that as a test to try to look for the impact of surrounding bodies. And we know that they are there. Here's a plot of the density of stars as a function of distance from the galactic center. There is a stellar cusp going inward. There are predictions for the remnant cusp, that is, not the stars themselves, but what's left behind after they evolve and die, black holes and neutron stars. So there should be a large number of massive objects surrounding Sagittarius Star, buffeting it. And you should think of Brownian motion. Okay, this is the direct analog of Brownian motion, where in this case, the black hole is the pollen grain, and the stars and the remnants are the water molecules.
Avery, the break, so there are two power laws in the density there, and the break happens because what are the power laws?
Why does the break happen? Yeah. So you form the black holes from the start. So firstly, this is taken from a paper by Dave Merritt. So I encourage you to read that. I'm going to give you my best recollection. The break happens because you form the remnants from the stars, but then the remnants segregate inward. Right? They're just more massive. They tend to kick lighter things out, and they move inward. And so I think what we're seeing is the mass segregation front as this stuff precipitates inwards to the center. Why is there a break in the stars? I think that's presumably caused by I think these simulations put in a nearly flat initial stellar distribution and then watch the cusp form. And so it takes some amount of time.
So these things change with time?
That's what these different lines, I think, are supposed to be showing.
Okay.
So this is very early, this is very late.
Oh.
Okay. But you know, this is a good point. Okay, so what does it really look like? The whole point would be to use Brownian motion to not infer the existence of atoms and molecules, but instead to infer the existence of these remnants and stars. So what we should see is not a stationary black hole, but the black hole bouncing around a little bit. And the scale here, this is a PowerPoint simulation, but the scale is about right. That shows how much this thing should be moving. Now, on top of this, add the fact that the light could be bouncing around all over the place, but the shadow, this ring-like feature, this thing is fixed to the mass. Right? And so if the mass moves around, we can figure out where it is. To do that, you need absolute astrometry. You need to be able to match up where the thing is night to night, year to year. That's difficult, but you can do it with the facilities in the EHT. So what would you get for that? You could imagine constructing a power spectrum of its motion. The power spectrum is dependent upon both how massive the typical things in the halo or the cusp around the black hole are and how many of them you have. And so you could distinguish things like an empty core or a flat core, maybe one of those very pessimistic models that cuts off just where we stop seeing, don't have enough resolution to see it continue to rise, or a core that consists of stars or stars and remnants. Okay? And that could, in principle, have implications for things like extreme mass ratio inspiral rates for LISA, because it'd be telling you how many stellar mass black holes, for example, you have around supermassive black holes. It would also be able to find coherent signals. So that's just the random Brownian motion signal, but you can have coherent signals associated with massive companions, and there's at least one reason to suspect there could be a massive companion. There are a number of massive stars near the galactic center, the so-called S stars. These are very special because groups in UCLA Andrea Ghez and company and groups in Germany, Rainer Gonzalez and company, have measured assiduously the orbits of these stars and used these to weigh the black hole at the galactic center. So when I say 4 million solar masses, that's where this comes from. It is the one black hole mass measurement you should believe. Where these came from, though, is something of a mystery. There are a number of reasons to think that it's very difficult to form them in situ, although there are ways around that. An alternative approach is that you made a globular cluster, and it fell inward, and at some point was tidally disrupted and deposited its components in these orbits down here. But in order to avoid becoming tidally disrupted much further out, you need some central potential to hold it together, and that would have taken the form, or needs to have taken the form, of an intermediate mass black hole. Nothing else will provide a deep enough potential to hold them all the way down. But if there was such a thing, okay, we would expect to see an intermediate mass black hole sometime within the lifetime of those S stars, so in the past, deposited in the past million years, on orbits comparable to where the S stars are located. And that would produce a signal, a deflection large enough on timescales of order a decade, that we could detect that with this absolute astrometric observations of Sagittarius star. So we'll see the reflex motion just in the way you look for planets these days.
So that's the smaller black hole dragging the bigger one around.
The smaller black hole.
They're orbiting each other.
Yes, right. Exactly. You'll see the reflex motion in the big black hole caused by the yeah. Okay, so if that were there, then we'd be able to see that as well. Moving down in order of magnitude and time scale, disk precession. So where does this picture come from? I already said that this dashed ring, this was due to gravitational lensing that's associated with the black hole. We have a bright side and a dim side. The bright side and the dim side are associated with orbiting gas. Okay, so we have a lot of information about Sagittarius star already. We know its mass. We have its SED, or its spectrum. We know something about polarization properties, and we have some theoretical reasons to believe that we should be looking at a geometrically thick orbiting synchrotron-emitting disk. One side comes towards us. It's Doppler beamed and Doppler boosted towards us, so we see a bright side, and one side recedes away from us, and it's correspondingly dim. Okay, so this image really comes down to how thick the disk is, which side's coming towards us, which side's going away from us, and what the inclination angle of the disk is relative to the line of sight. You can construct models or libraries of models of these sorts of images that are characterized by the black hole parameters with all the rest of the disk parameters fixed by the SED. Oops. Is that better? Okay. Fixed by the SED, and the three spin parameters we have would be the magnitude, inclination relative to the line of sight, and the position angle, what direction the disk axis is on the sky. We have data from that past 10 years from the proto-EHT. I don't really want you to read through this, except to note that there are many lines. Each one of these lines has a number of data points associated with it, and it comes in two flavors. One is something about the magnitude of the Fourier transform of the image, and the other one is something about its phase. And fitting those sorts of disk models to that proto-EHT data, for those three parameters, we can produce some posterior parameter distribution. I don't really want you to look at this. Let's just note the central panel shows disk spin magnitude and disk inclination. And note that a lot of this is empty. This is dark blue is low probability. Red is high probability. Okay, the one sigma family of images, that is models that live on this solid line here, okay, is shown here. They do differ. If you look close enough, you can tell the difference between them, but it's hard for me to as well. And a number of phenomenological models are completely ruled out. We do see something associated with the structure of this image, something associated with the crescent.
So you're saying from this that it's not spinning very fast?
That would be our best guess right now, yes. Okay. So there are disks.
Sorry, this is coming from where? Why do we think that it's not spinning fast?
Well,
I mean, spin is a tricky thing to measure, especially for supermassive black holes.
Yeah, yeah. So practically in the fits, what's happening is holding the total intensity fixed. As you spin up the black hole, the emission region on the approaching side becomes brighter and more compact.
Oh, okay.
And so the size measurements from the proto-EHT observations, effectively the size limits, are placing a constraint on the spin just from that.
How sure are you that what you're seeing is the disk and not the base of the jet?
For Sagittarius Star? Yeah. I mean, we could talk at length about whether or not there's any evidence for a jet in Sagittarius Star. I would say right now I'm not sure, except for the fact that the disk model seems to do a good job across all observation epochs, independently, you know. Right? And that's actually, I'll show that in a moment. But yeah, so there's an assumption here that we're using the right emission region morphology. Okay, and that's not something that formally I'm not going to ever be able to say, I'm sure we're using the right model, right?
I think you can say it's not a jet. That's going to be fair.
Maybe. Okay, so you go talk to people from Nijmegen. They'll make images of jets that look very similar to this because they're saying that the emission's coming from the jet disk interface. Yeah. No, I understand. Okay. So the orientation as seen from the center of the galaxy looks something like this. I don't really want to belabor this plot. It's just, you know, the sky. There are two high probability regions because it's hard to tell the difference between a disk that's tilted like this and one that's tilted like that when they're nearly optically thin. But it is consistent with other features that we see in the galactic center, like orbiting infrared gas clouds that did not fully tidally disrupt as advertised. But more importantly, perhaps, with the disk of stars that is the presumed source of the accretion flow onto Sagittarius Star. So if nothing else, at least it looks like the angular momentum of the gas in the disk, which is assumed to be aligned with the spin of the black hole, is aligned with the angular momentum of the gas that's being supplied. Okay? But there's a different way to look at this, and this was about variability. And that is that we have one model that works over 7 years, okay, all the way from 2007 to 2013. And in fact, it works independently on each night. So here's each one of the observation epochs, each one of these data sets broken up into individual days and individual years. And this is just one of the reconstructed parameters, the position angle, the orientation on the sky, how far east of north it is. And it's consistent across the entire time. That is to say, we don't see the structure of the image evolving. And that's slightly mysterious, because there are reasons to have expected that it could generically evolve. The reason why people might imagine it wouldn't be, is the Bardeen-Peterson effect. So this is associated with a thin disk that's misaligned relative to the spin of the black hole. And as that disk, as the material in the disk accretes onto the black hole, accretes towards the black hole, lens steering torques cause the disk to precess. That leads to a warp. The warp becomes increasingly radical. And viscous torques in between neighboring rings damp away the inclination, and you end up with an aligned disk down at the center. Now, here's an image of this from a paper a few years ago by Nielsen, Price, and Nixon. It shows a thin disk, and it's aligned down near the black hole as a consequence of these sorts of torques. I should point out that they also say interesting things can happen when you have highly misaligned disks. But the gas in the galactic center, you know, we have no obvious reason. I could tell you a story, but we have no obvious reason, certainly no proof, for the angular momentum of the accreting gas to be aligned with the black hole. So generically, we might expect to find ourselves in this situation. Okay. But thick disks are very different from thin disks in that they very efficiently propagate torques. And here is a simulation of a thick disk by Chris Fagill, misaligned by, I think, 15 degrees relative to the spin of the central black hole. And you can see that the thick disk is almost rigidly precessing. And in fact, the whole thing rigidly precesses about. The inner torques, the lensing at the inner edge, are much higher than the lensing torques at the outer edge, but the disk is locked together by the strong torques within the disk. Okay, and that means that if we had a generically misaligned accretion flow, we would expect the image of Sagittarius A star to wobble over a time scale comparable to the typical lens theorem precession time. And for the galactic center, that's something on the order of a couple of years, though that depends upon the magnitude of the spin, how misaligned it is, and the size of the accretion disk. Because in order to drag the entire accretion disk around, you have to drag all the angular momentum, most of it lies at the outer edge, around. Okay, so.
And this cannot be mistaken for the Brownian motion that you showed before.
Well, this is just a change in the orientation of the accretion flow.
Turning. The position is the same, but it's just switching.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, so here's our constraint on that, arising from taking each one of those knights, putting in a precession model in between them, trying to match them up in a coordinated way. At the moment, we see nothing. There is the fact that we didn't, that all the knights were consistent with a single model. We knew a priori we weren't going to see anything. But we can already start to say that the outer disk radius has to be larger than the orbits of the S stars. There's nothing particularly wrong with that. Or the spin has to be relatively low. Okay. There's some interesting dark low probability features in here, or things that lie on these fixed precession timescale lines. Those arise because we keep observing at the same time of the year, and so anything that's a harmonic of 1 year is indistinguishable.
Do you know anything about the distance of lower spins from
absorption? No, at least I don't, and the people I've asked don't, but maybe there is something, I don't know. One thing that's kind of entertaining about this to me is if there are many elements of the precession model, it's not quite as simple as just putting in spin and outer disk radius. There's also the orientation of the precession axis, the initial orientation of the angular momentum relative to it, and all of that. Okay, and most of those are horribly, horribly degenerate because you can arrange one in any way you want. It turns out that the one thing that's well constrained is disk outer radius relative to spin. So it's one of these magical things where everything's degenerate except the one thing you care about. So I thought that was entertaining. Jet origins. Now we're down to days. So I belabored the point a little bit at the beginning that supermassive black holes are not incidental. They're not curiosities sitting at the centers of galaxies, but in fact, major movers in the universe. And one of the ways they do this is through these jets. But where do they come from? So the second horizon science target for the EHT is M87. Okay, it is as different from Sagittarius A star as you can be. It's 2,000 times more massive, where Sagittarius A star is a very typical supermassive black hole in the universe. M87 is an extraordinary one, something around 7 billion solar masses. And it also has a powerful jet, or at least a prominent jet. Here it's shown in the optical. Here it's shown in a number of different scales in the radio. Okay, just for reference, this image, a similar image of Sagittarius A star, and on this sort of scale would look like a single point. Okay, so when it comes back to does Sagittarius A star have a jet, this is what a jet source looks like. And Sagittarius A star looks like a marker. So I don't know, but it doesn't look like it to me. Here's a 7-millimeter VLBA image, okay, milliarc seconds. So this is 1,000 times bigger than the microarc seconds we were talking about. This is about 100 Schwarzschild radii. And this is a movie generated by Walker and Company. And in it, you can see ejections of stuff flowing outward. If you're particularly cynical, you might just call those calibration artifacts. But if you're somewhat optimistic, you might call that actual variability. Craig Walker is one of the most cynical people I know, and he believes they're actual variability, so that's good enough for me.
So what is the center? The center of the black hole is the blue spot.
That's a really good question. So it isn't immediately obvious from this picture, but as you go to higher and higher frequency, the location of this spot doesn't change.
Yeah.
The location of where you see out to in the jet does converge down. So Yes, the thinking is that this is in fact where the black hole is located.
So is this one rotating actually?
Is this rotating? Well, this is just an image. Who knows what we're looking at, right?
Yeah.
But the jet is extended in this direction.
Okay.
And it extends out in that direction on large scale.
The other direction.
Yeah, you don't see the other side. Well, Craig would say that you do see the barest hint of the counterjet, but you don't see the other side because of relativistic beaming. This side's coming towards us. The other side goes away from us.
Okay,
so based on this, a student of mine, Britt Jeter, and I thought a little bit about how that variability might differ as seen by Sagittarius Star for different, as seen by the EHT, for different models of jet production. And the key physics input here is the realization that the velocity flow in a typical jet structure varies tremendously inside and outside the jet. There's some line that kind of defines the edge of the jet. We call this the critical field line. Inside, you have nearly pointing pure, so electromagnetically dominated, highly relativistic stuff. Outside this line, you have most of the winds, disk winds, that is pressure dominated by electromagnetic fields, but mass, energy dominated by the mass. So this stuff is trans-relativistic at the edge, gammas of order 2. And less outwards. Okay, these two models could produce the kinds of jets we see. It seems that jets need at least three ingredients. They need angular momentum, they need magnetic fields, and they need Roger Blanford, because all of the jets are Blanford something. This would be the Blanford-Nyack model. Out here is the Blanford-Payne type models, disk-launched jets. Okay.
Densities, these are equal density contours, the colors?
The colors are showing, the arrows are showing the poloidal velocity, and the color scheme is showing the azimuthal velocity, okay? And the physics realization is that the shearing inside the jet and the shearing outside the jet is very different, okay? So if we put a blob of material, whatever is producing those 7-millimeter blobs, inside the jet or outside the jet, it shears out in a very different way as it propagates along the jet. And so just to illustrate the boundary, if we put in a nearly Gaussian blob initially at some height, about 10m above the black hole, by 30m, it's completely elongated out into this crescent. And if we put it inside the jet, it wraps around. And outside the jet, it stays more blob-like. The result is a set of images that evolve very differently. Inside the jet has a hat. Looks, I think that's a tuk. Okay, outside the jet just looks like a stick. And on that critical field line, quite properly, looks like a hockey stick. It's a tuk and a stick. Okay, so we can tell from the morphology of the images the difference between things put inside the jet and outside the jet because of the shearing velocity flow. These features are prominent both at large distances. Note that this is 500-ish, 600-ish microarc seconds, but also on horizon scales. Things inside the jet and outside the jet look dramatically different. So in principle, the EHT can tell which one of these we're looking at, whether or not we're looking at M87's a Blanford-Nyack jet or a Blanford-Payne jet, with implications for all the other jets in the universe. An interesting thing is that the EHT doesn't even have to actually generate images to answer this question. There's a quantity closure phase that can be constructed by summing the phase information from three different baselines. Okay, it's just a way to get a well-defined measure of the phase of the Fourier transform of the image, and every triangle admits one of these. And we see different behaviors on the for the closure phase as a function of time for different kinds of jets, for jets or spots launched outside, Blanford-Payne type jet, spots launched inside, Blanford-Nyack type jet. In each one of these, we show as a function of time, because as the Earth rotates, the base, the stations are moving. Okay, so they're seeing a different closure phase as a function of time, and then as a function of day. And the light blue is the start. The purple is the end. From light to dark to purple is the time evolution. And when we're outside the jet, we see the closure phase go up and come back down. So I think of this as pushing the child responsibly on the swing. When we're on that critical field line, just at the boundary, we see it go up and then down. This is how children push themselves on the swing. But the really interesting thing happens when we put it inside the jet. It goes down, falls off the bottom, comes in the top, and settles. That's how children want to be pushed on the swing. But it's, it doesn't go back. So it's like a winding number. And so we've looked at this, and I keep talking to solid-state physicists. Maybe some people in this room will have good answers for me. This looks topological because it goes to a different branch, and then it stays there. There's a winding number you could, in principle, measure. And it's associated with defects in the phase structure of the Fourier transform of the image. That sounds like lattice defects in crystals. And so surely there's a mapping to some interesting topological feature in the image that I should be able to extract from this, but I don't know what that is. So consider this a plea for help.
But the real space image looked rather mundane.
Yeah, the real space images look like combinations of multiple components moving around in some way. So why is there something topologically different? Interestingly, this closure phase thing is sort of a three-point Riemann sum of a contour integral in this phase space, which it's very easy to understand why you pick up a winding number whenever you have these defects move through your triangle.
Presumably it's because the image is just being translated.
Is it just being, the translation wouldn't produce any shifts in the closure phase?
Nothing, translational standpoint.
Yeah, nothing. So that's an interesting nugget just throw out there. The final thing that I want to talk about is space-time tomography. Now we're down to minutes, not hours. About once a day, Sagittarius A star, remember that's the galactic center, we've returned, flares. Here's a movie from the UCLA Galactic Center Group that shows the infrared emission from Sag A star, and you see it suddenly pops up, even in this bright room. Astronomy, of course, should be done at night. And so once per day, we see flaring. Its brightness can increase by 1 to 2 orders of magnitude on a time scale of tens of minutes. We had some talk at lunch about whether or not there are QPOs in Sag A star. So if you're Reinhard Genzel, you'll draw this picture and you'll say, look, that's a QPO. Other people may not agree with him. In the X-rays, we see similar types of behavior, except none of the, not nearly as much repeating. Most infrared flares don't repeat like this. And you see variability all the way down into the radio. And again, this happens once per day. So what is the cause of this? The picture that I have in my head is that these are akin to solar flares. And the reason for that is the accretion flow of Sag A star must be radiatively inefficient. There's just too much stuff going in and too little light coming out. So by definition, it's radiatively inefficient. And radiatively inefficient accretion flows have a lot more energy available to be radiated than they're effectively radiating. So any dissipative process that dumps energy into electrons will instantly raise the emission of the accretion flow dramatically in short order. And these processes happen anytime you're dragging magnetic field lines around. And here's a very, very local example of this in the outer layers of the sun. Magnetic fields are dragged around by convection cells, and they produce solar flares. So I imagine that these things, flares in the galactic center, are akin to solar flares in the sense that they are dissipative events driven by magnetic reconnection in the middle of a turbulent flow.
How big is a magnetic field?
Sag A star?
Yeah.
10 to 100 gaps?
It's very small.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be particularly large to produce. I mean, there's far more energy in the ions in the accretion flow than there are in the electron. So even if a tiny fraction of the energy in the ions get dumped into the electrons, the electrons don't have to become energetically important. Their pressure doesn't have to matter at all. They're not dynamically important. But they can suddenly radiate an order of magnitude or two more. Okay. So this is the picture that I have in my head. We've been thinking about this for longer than I'd like to recall. Here's a simulation or a movie we made a long time ago that shows an orbiting spot. So the idea is that this reconnection event has occurred, and the energized electrons are moving around in a compact region trapped on the local turbulence. And you can see how that would lead to flares when viewed at the right angle. It's hard to see this given the lighting, but with time, we see this from a more inclined perspective, and the more inclined perspective results in larger gravitational lensing that happens when the spot comes just around the back side of the black hole, and that produces the flash. In that, presuming that the spot stayed cohesive as a single spot is not well formed over many, many orbits. And here's a simulation of the density distribution of those electrons, assuming that they just stay on the local velocity lines of the fluid. That is, they're just tracers in the accretion flow formed by student Paul Tita and postdoc Hung-Yi Pu here. And you can see that it stretches out rather rapidly, okay? So that we should be talking about shearing spots. And this one also accretes. The picture, the movie I showed you before, just had an orbiting spot. So what does that look like? Here's a movie made by Britt Jeter compared to a simulation by Otaka Shiokawa. This is a GR MHD simulation that has some radiative module stuck on it so that you can see the emission. This one spot shears out and produces a bunch of wispy-like features. I am struck by the similarities between these. It suggests that maybe running a full GR MHD simulation is a little bit of overkill for this. And instead, perhaps we could model these GR MHD simulations with just collections of spots. This is, in some sense, just trying to model the accretion flow by a bunch of blobs, which would be a non-parametric modeling of the accretion flow in physical space instead of an image. Okay. But regardless of what exactly, and I'll show you some recent results associated with those sorts of shearing spots, but regardless of what those spots look like exactly, you can imagine trying to back out their existence, modifications in the structure during flares, and maybe even some properties of the accretion flow by looking at some of the individual interferometric observables, things like that closure phase. And in fact, a number of years ago, we looked at doing this exactly for a triangle that we didn't have at the time, and I suppose we'll never have because of bad karma. But we certainly were able to show that the fluctuations in the closure phase on different triangles varied tremendously based upon the source of the variability in the image. So exactly what kind of spot we put in. This is true beyond just putting in localized spots. Even with turbulent accretion flows, you see similar things. You can measure at least that there's structural variability. So to try to put this on firmer analysis footing, we've begun the process of trying to assess how well we could back out properties of the spot and the space-time from observations of one of these shearing dissipative events. And towards that, Paul's made a four-frame movie in quotes. We have to start somewhere. And with that four-frame movie generated simulated data. This is the full movie. He picked four frames from this movie. And then begun the process of trying to fit for each one of the parameters that go into the definition of the spot. Those are things like the black hole spin inclination and position angle, things like the density and initial location of the spot, and some properties of the accretion flow velocity. The one thing that I think is interesting here is that most of these are local. Okay, the black hole spin inclination and position angle define the space-time in this case. Here, we really only need to know the infall velocity and angular velocity at a handful of positions near the spot, and the initial positions, initial density, are just one parameter. So we don't have to do a global reconstruction of the accretion flow to understand the structure of the spot. Just focusing on a handful of that enormous set of different parameters, here I'm showing the black hole spin, the initial radius, and also here, and the infall velocity, how rapidly things are infalling. And if you put a spot at 7 gravitational radii, so 3.5 Schwarzschild radii, This gives you an idea of how well in this highly idealized situation we could extract these parameters. Okay, you can do this again at larger radii, this one at 10m. Okay, and here these two plots have been superposed. The things that are colored blue are the close-in one. The things that are red are the more distant. And a few things are immediately apparent. The first is we should be able to tell that their positions are different. We can do that fairly well. We should be able to tell that their infall velocities are different, thereby measuring something like the radial velocity as a function of position. But we should be able to find that the spin is the same, because that's a property that's defined by the space-time. So you could imagine doing this again for many, many spots. So we observe many flares. We look for just the brightest ones and run this sort of analysis and reconstruct as a function of initial spot radius what the spin of the black hole looks like. That's really a measure of the spin of the black hole through different portions of the space-time. And Kerr makes a very strong prediction that they had better all be the same. And that would be, in some sense, tomographically mapping the underlying space-time. But there's a lot left to do here. We have to put in not just four frames from the movie, put in the full movie. I think that will improve the ability to determine anything. But then we also have to put in additional sources of systematic uncertainty that are not included yet. All right. Yes?
This is just doing. Do you have any polarization information? Sorry.
So things I didn't talk about.
Okay.
Number five, polarization. We get the full set of Stokes parameters, I, Q, U, and V. We've reported Q and U before. We have V measurements that I don't think we've reported because they're good to maybe 20%. But they do say something about magnetic morphologies and could say something about hotspots. I didn't talk about the inverse imaging problem. Even with all the stations we have now, which is wonderful, we are still in the sparse coverage limit. So producing an image, while possible, is marginally difficult, especially when you have intrinsically variable systems. One of the assumptions most imaging techniques make use of is that during the entire period of observation, the underlying system does not evolve. So that allows you to use your evolving baselines due to the rotation of the Earth to fill in your UV coverage. But that's probably not true. So as a collaboration, the EHT has been exploring how to overcome that. I've not talked at all about the mitigation of a variety of observational systematics, all the way from station calibration to dealing with interstellar scattering. I've not talked about timescales less than minutes, things like MHD turbulence. We saw a lot of structure in the GRMHD simulation that was not associated with those dissipative events because they weren't included in that simulation. What was shown there was entirely magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. We can learn something about the statistics of MHD turbulence by looking at short timescales. I didn't say anything about non-parametric analyses. Okay, so these are phenomenological models or looking at power spectra, et cetera. I didn't say anything about polarization. I didn't say anything about how we actually are looking forward to modeling accretion flows in a way that accounts for the large number of systematic uncertainties that we currently are facing. Certainly not how we do this or validate these things against GRMHD simulations and suites of such simulations. I didn't talk about modifications of the underlying space-times. I didn't talk about the fact that EHT observations are associated with a large multi-wavelength endeavor. So we actually do have light curves from the radio all the way to the gamma rays. And we'll be adding the varying event horizon scale structure. I didn't talk about sources other than Sagittarius and M87, but we do observe them. Things like OJ287, which is a quasar that people think is a binary. And I didn't talk anything about how we're doing these analyses and developing the framework to do this for the EHT that allows us to fold all this information in. But if you'd like to, I will be around. And in summary, I just want to say that images are coming soon-ish. At least they're coming to people who are in the EHT soon-ish. So people at Perimeter certainly are welcome to participate in that. We may not release those until 2019, but we'll see what we see. All the EHT targets should be exhibiting structural variability on very short timescales, minutes to hours, and then all the way up to decades. And they all tell different stories. And so stay tuned for the next 100. Thank you.
So this quasar, that's a binary. What are its properties? Are these just supermassive black holes orbiting each other?
So there's, I think they're Finnish. The Finnish group noticed that every 12 years there was a bright optical flare from this quasar. Then they went through all this historical data and they would find, they went back as far as they could go and they verified that in fact every 12 years. And then they made a prediction that this was going to happen a few years ago and it happened again. The basis for their prediction is a model in which you have one black hole crashing through the accretion disk of the other. And that is the reason why people think it's a binary. In the radio, it's a mess. It's all over the place. There's a jet-like feature that's flying all over the place. I don't know. It looks complicated to me. But yeah, it could be a binary.
You have the bullet point here, the nuclear remnant population. I was thinking of this with your plot from Merit of the black holes. And there were also, presumably you would have neutron stars and dwarfs. And I seem to remember papers predicting fast populations of neutron stars and pulsars in the vicinity of the black hole. Have these been found?
Have pulsars been found? There's the magnetar, which is worse than, this is a case where one is worse than zero. No, they have not found these. So actually, that's one of the commensal science modes that I thought I even had that on there. I said OJ-287. 3C239, and pulsars. Okay, so one of the things the EHT does is it phases up ALMA. ALMA's a wonderful instrument. It's EHT, it's one station. And so we just phase it all up coherently and use it as one station. And that means we make one of the most sensitive millimeter instruments available. And so you can use that to hunt for pulsars. So people in the EHT are doing that. But the reason why you want to hunt for pulsars with something like ALMA is there have been a number of pulsar searches in the galactic center. They have all come up with empty. The reason for this is believed to be scattering delays. So it's, pulsars are themselves not hugely bright, so you find them by looking for something that's pulsing. But if the light comes to you both directly and scatters and comes to you, and the scattering delay is comparable to the pulsar period, then you don't see it. Okay, if you go to shorter and shorter wavelengths, the scattering delay gets shorter and shorter, and at some point it becomes smaller than the pulse period. Okay, so the idea is to go to shorter, shorter wavelengths, make scattering subdominant, and then you see the pulsars. And the great hope is that we'll find something in a very short, tight orbit around Sagittarius Star, and we'll have our perfect pulsar black hole system, and we'll just clean up on everything. But, as I said, sometimes one is worse than none, and there is a magnetar discovered fairly close to the galactic center, I think within a tenth of a parsec or so. It's not close enough to do all the cool things, and a magnetar is the wrong kind of pulsar to do any cool things with. But the part that's terribly frustrating is they detected it in the radio after detecting it first in the gamma rays, and the scattering delays didn't stop you from detecting it, so now nobody understands why we don't have large populations of pulsars in the galactic center. So, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to find there.
You had a movie of stars cycling around a black hole earlier at the talk. Can you put that back on?
Sure.
A nasty thing. And I'll apologize now for the stupidity of my question.
Oh.
But was that an optical image?
Was that an optical image? Let's. There's the big one.
That's it. Okay.
That's it. Yeah.
This was Keck. Near infrared adaptive optics, is that not right?
Yeah, yeah, right. So, clean to Keck near.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a model.
It's
no,
a model.
No.
Okay.
No, it's not a model. No, okay.
If you saw the images.
No, I've seen the images. The images are actually pretty decent, but they don't look like this.
You're thinking of the speckle, the early speckle stuff.
No, with AO, you see the diffraction pattern, and the way you know that this is cleaned is because they're not all little hexagons. Right, so, but it's real. I mean, those are the stars.
Excellent. Can you measure the redshift on those?
Can you measure the redshift? You mean the gravitational redshift from sitting near the black hole?
Like gravity's playing a big effect there. I just wondered what you would see if you just looked at the redshift of the different stars.
These are out at, I think the closest, the periastron approach for S2. So this guy right here, right there is 2,000 gravitational radii.
And
so that's a little.
Are they moving?
Yes, pretty fast. But at the top of my head,
it's 10 years, right? That movie's 10 years long?
Yeah.
I'm not sure which. 95 to 2000 and something.
Yeah, this is about 10 years. That's the orbital period of S2 is approximately 10 years.
Right, so that's ridiculously fast, isn't it?
And I think it would distort things like crazy.
Yeah, well, they have line of sight velocities from measuring the redshifts of these. So they have the full 3D. They actually have, as a function of time, they have the full 3D velocities for each one of these stars.
So I'd just like to overlay that. I'd like to overlay redshift on that 3D image that you have and see if it makes sense.
It does. They put that in the orbital fits, but they actually now they have a simulation that they like to show. It's this beautiful outreach movie that shows in 3D the orbits and how they're foreshortened and all of that. But that goes into it. But I don't think they include the gravitational redshift, and I'm not sure if they would notice it right now.
But wouldn't it be enormous?
No, it's 2000. Well, I mean, so it depends on what you mean by enormous. Okay, so I spend half my time thinking about z equals one objects. That's enormous. So this is like z of 1,000. Or z of, 1.0001 or something. It's that big.
As I said,
they do throw in those terms for even normal binary stars these days. So they may have done that.
On the other hand, they do all kinds of other things. Like they, in these movies, I believe that the fact that S2's orbit closes was a calibration condition. Because the hardest part of this is not observing S2. It's actually registering the images day after day, year after year. How do you know how to line up the pictures?
Especially such a small field like that.
Yeah. And everything's moving. It's a nightmare. Which is very impressive. And they're now able to just about start doing this without assuming it closes, right? And that's, of course, the thing you want to do to see post-Newtonian effects. You want to see precessions. And if you assume the orbit closes, you eliminate that, right? That's one of the things the reasons why these people in particular, the UCLA group in particular, and others are excited about the next generation telescopes, because they want to redo this experiment, but with stars closer to the black hole, and they'll be able to do better. There was another hand.
You mentioned multi-wavelength campaigns, which sounds kind of interesting. Yeah. So they go right through the optical, the UV, everything, and they're coordinated at the same time?
Well, not the optical and the UV for Sagittarius Star, but infrared, X-ray, gamma ray. I think we had some atmospheric Cherenkov telescopes all the way down into radio.
And they don't do the optical just because of the obscuration?
Yeah, there's nothing.
Even with Hubble, you can't.
You can't see through the dust in the galaxy in Hubble.
Well, I mean, you said infrared, so it's...
So infrared we can do from...
Yeah, but Hubble's infrared.
Is it? Oh, okay. That was optical and UV.
Yeah, infrared.
Okay, well, I mean, we have Keck. I don't think we had Hubble. So now during each one of these campaigns, there's a concerted effort to get a large number of other wavelengths on board for commensal observing. Of course, they can't cover the entire time, all the time, and we have situations where they're observing before the EHD starts to observe, and frequently their schedules have to get set long before the EHD schedule gets set, so we don't end up covering each other all the time. But there are these impressive plots that show all the way through the electromagnetic spectrum what we have covered from hour to hour. So that information is available. Yep.
So the Sagittarius Star-like emission, as you say, is much fainter than other massive black holes and such. Mm-hmm. Do you expect it to scale just with the event horizon size, basically, just with mass?
Do I expect
emission?
The
I mean, too naive.
Do I expect the emission to scale with the mass?
Yes, the synchrotron emission from the disk that you think is giving you.
No. It doesn't, right? So I mean, Sagittarius star is it's exceedingly underluminous, at least because its accretion rate's very low.
Right.
In order to make M87 similarly luminous, even though it's 1,000 times further away.
I'm not saying that. I want to argue for BS black holes in our galaxy. What kind of emission rate might you expect?
Yeah, we can work that out. I think for the same Eddington ratio, it goes down with black hole mass. So this is, no, that can't be right. That can't be right.
Yeah, we got to talk. We should talk, because I think we're at the verge of being able to detect this in some of the stellar mass black holes.
Okay. Detect what exactly?
Detect emission like Sagittarius star. They're simply inefficient.
Well, there are other inefficient
sure.
X-ray binaries. Even.
This inefficient.
Yeah, okay.
Inefficient.
Yep.
The question about your multi-wavelength studies you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You're not talking about the gravitational lensing there. You're talking about sort of straight up imaging.
Yeah, well, all of the other wavelengths don't resolve the horizon at all, right?
So, yeah, so, but I guess my so part two.
Although I guess I should be a little bit careful. The EHT right now observes at 1.3 millimeters.
Yeah.
But it can also observe at 0.87, and the first actual intercontinental demonstrations of that are being planned right now. So that would be multi-wavelength, but
for going to shorter wavelengths.
What?
There was an obvious advantage for going to shorter wavelengths.
Yeah.
Resolution and stuff.
Yeah.
So I wondered, like, are there any other sources out there? Because obviously you can't just use the microwave background, but could you look at a star that was further away than what you're interested in and use the? I'm sure that there's obviously a reason why this is not a good idea, but I just can't think what it is.
So
if I had a black hole here and a star behind it.
Yeah.
Can I look at the lensing of that star due to the black hole? And I could do that in the visible or whatever.
Yeah.
In the infrared.
I mean, people do that with microlensing, right? That's what microlensing events are. You wait for a thing, a massive thing, it could be another star, it could be a black hole, pass in front of some background object. The thing is, you don't know where all the lenses are, and so what you end up doing is just staring at all the stars and waiting for one of them to start to get brighter, and then you look at that one. And believe it or not, people actually run surveys like this. It's truly incredible, and they can catch thousands of them a year. We actually wrote a paper. Let's see, Mansoor Karami, this guy right here, and I wrote a paper saying that you could follow up a subset of those with imaging. Now, the problem is most stars are radio dim. But a subset of radio bright, or in the era of SKA, maybe even with CHIME, you could run a radio microlensing survey. Right? So those are seeing the entire sky repeatedly. And you just wait for a radio, an AGN, to brighten in the right way, which is a little bit of a complicated thing because they're always brightening and dimming. And then you go image that thing and do exactly this sort of experiment. But I think in order to see the microlensing multiple images, you still need milliarcsecond resolution, which still will put it too difficult a place for optical or infrared. Okay. Even though there are infrared interferometers, so the VLT has four 8-meter eight-meter telescopes that are arranged as an interferometer. Keck was an interferometer. So people do play this game in the infrared, but it is massively more difficult.
Because you can build bigger interferometers in the radio than you could in the infrared.
Yeah. In the radio, we have a perfect amplifier. It's called copy, right? Because so that sounds like, to everybody who understands quantum mechanics, that's cheating. It's obviously cheating. But the reason is because we're in the high occupancy limit. And so when we copy the data stream, so we can correlate this guy with this guy, we can make a copy of the disk and correlate it with this third guy, et cetera. If you want to do infrared interferometry, you're in the low marginal to low occupation number limit, and there you're actually running the quantum interferometric experiment where you split the photon, you run it down both paths, and you interfere it, and you generate some at the end. And that means that you lose intensity every time you do this. And it's more complicated, but people have done this. And there's an instrument called Gravity on the VLT, which does this, and phase references, which has just now come online. And so they hope to see they hope to be able to watch these stars much more accurately. But they also hope to see during flares Sagittarius star kind of move over, come back. So they can't make an image of Sagittarius star. It's not good enough resolution to do that. But the centroid value of their blob, they can measure to a microarc second. And so they can see the centroid of the light in the infrared go. I guess I should do it this way, like that, right? And that would be really cool. So they do think about that, but it is a massively more difficult thing.
Following up on that, the correlation obviously is a tricky problem, as Michael spends his career doing that correlation business. And for intercontinental, it's essentially impossible, I guess. How does that happen?
What do you mean impossible?
And it was in fact one of your colleagues, who's Daniel, who's not here anymore, right? That proposed your photon splitting over long distances.
Oh right. Oh yes, right. In the infrared, I spoke to all the infrared people, and they said it was impossible because you didn't have. You had too much. It was too lossy to send these photons very far. Yeah. So you could, in principle, in the infrared, extend it. You don't have to go to intercontinental to make huge changes, though, right? The VLT is all the telescopes are easily within sight of each other. You could move the thing order of magnitude further apart, and that would be a huge.
When does that become your resolution limit, though? When does the jitter in the correlation become?
Oh. I don't know for infrared. For VLBI, I don't think that ever sets our limit, right? I mean, you have to. I guess I'm unsure what you mean by the jitter. I mean, you have to do a fringe search. That gets very expensive, especially as you go to shorter wavelength, because essentially, you're taking these two data streams and you're trying to line them up to find out when their cross correlation is maximized, and that happens on a time delay of a fraction of a period, and that means you have to know the positions of all your stations to a quarter wavelength. And if you do millimeter VLBI, that means we have to know the positions of all these places on the Earth through a quarter of a millimeter, which is difficult, but people do it. You have to have a good local oscillator to mix down the signal. I'm not sure how they do that in the infrared, to be honest. I know that you know, masers, hydrogen masers are satisfactory for this. So what other jitter in the correlation are you?
Well, we talked about clocks this morning, and we've got some single photon people in the room as well. So when that becomes a limit, I can imagine that we might be able to do some experiments, interesting experiments there. To improve that.
Yeah, yeah.
Worry about losing coherence.
Yeah.
So that's for unconnected elements. I think you can live with that. Because your clocks are never perfectly, I mean, in VLBI, you never have them. They're not on the same clock. You always have to do your fringe search to find it. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of how consistent it is on short time scales. Limits anyone. That part doesn't limit anyone at all. Atmospheric coherence is a big problem. Millimeter wavelengths.
Yeah. But that's a brightness limit problem.
Right. Yeah.
But so, I know that at one point we weren't sure. The people who worry about these things, which is not me. I worry about modeling. But people who worry about these things weren't sure that hydrogen masers were going to be stable enough at the short polling times necessary to provide the local oscillator at 300 gigahertz. But it turns out that's fine.
Yeah.
The atmospheric coherence time is a problem. Yeah. And I don't think you can. You have to, I mean, this is the point, is when you get to the low photon occupancy limit, you have to have a connected element interferometer. Then it's the quantum experiment.
Okay, here again.